Let's start off by setting your motivation. Very often, Venerable Children reminds us that bodhisattvas have this constant motivation that everything they do is for the benefit of others. And so when we think of ourselves in relation to bodhisattvas, we may find this motivation quite, perhaps in moments, impossible. But actually, an aspiration is a way of guiding our mind to this kind of goal. And everyone is capable of making this very aspiration. May whatever I do be of benefit for others. And so if we look at what we've done today, if I look at what I've done today, there were a few moments where I had that clearly in my mind. And then there are many other moments where it was just not there at all. I'm quite sure when I added the jelly to my peanut butter sandwich, it wasn't for the benefit of all human beings or sentient beings. It was so that I could have some pleasure. But the thing about an aspiration is that we just keep resetting it. And then whatever we do, we can just reframe it. For example, today in the New York Times, there's an article about another benefit of exercise. And today's topic is that it'll help us have healthy eyes into our old age, that it could very well be a remedy to not get macular degeneration. And so we can look at this and think, okay, I'm going to exercise so that I can have healthy eyes. And by having healthy eyes, then I can read the Dharma well into my old age for the benefit of all sentient beings. And then while we're eating, we can think, okay, there's some choices here. Most of what's offered is very nutritious. But is eating the Haagen-Dazs ice cream going to be of benefit for all sentient beings if I have it? And so I can see that this constant reminder to ourselves, to myself, is this going to be of benefit, really helps me decide throughout the day how I use my time. So you might think for a moment, right now, how was it for you today in doing things for the benefit of all sentient beings? And so we have this opportunity now to hear a review of Venerable Children's teaching, and we can put that motivation in our mind right now by listening to this review. May some of the topics really go in more deeply this time. May I make the opportunity later on to reflect on these topics and come to understand them so that can continue walking towards this goal of full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. So then my children has gone on a journey to the east part of the United States. Tonight she's teaching in Milwaukee, and then tomorrow night until April 1st she's in Medford, Massachusetts, and after that she's in Cleveland April 2nd to April 3rd, and then she's in Chicago April 5th to 6th, and a lot of these teachings are going to be videotaped, is that right, Venerable Damcho? And they'll be posted at some point on the website so we can view these teachings. So tonight I'm going to do a review of Chapter 7. And actually, my dear Dharma friends here decided that it would happen tonight and next Thursday as well. So actually, it is a good thing because the first verse of Chapter 7, verse 151, Venerable Children, way back in October, took an entire hour and 10 minutes just to do that one verse. And then for the subsequent verses in Chapter 7, it took another 3.5 classes. So even tonight and next Thursday, I'm not going to get through all the material, but we'll make a start on it. So for the benefit of all sentient beings, we'll give it a go. So just as a review, Chapter 6 was abandoning the afflictions, and Chapter 7 is going to go into the objects of these afflictions, the sense objects. So this chapter is going to target the disadvantages of cyclic existence, and it will do that by looking at the Four Noble Truths, meditating on the first two, the true dukkha and true origins of true dukkha, and then in terms of the Lam Rim, this teaching will be considering the path in common with the middle practitioner. So in getting into this, Venerable Children spent a few minutes just warming us up last time, getting us ready to hear about verse 151. And so she was saying this: by cultivating an understanding of the disadvantages of cyclic existence, we see why it's necessary to have a sense of danger or fear. So this is not the panicky fear that we want to cultivate. We know how to do that. We've done it all our lives. I've done it all my life anyway. And we've done it in previous lives. But this is a cultivation of the wisdom kind of fear. So when Venerable uses the word danger, she says, think of it as a sense of caution. It is wise and appropriate to have a sense of caution about certain things in life. So in a worldly sense, we all know that when we're on a bicycle and we're in traffic, we don't assume for a moment, at least we shouldn't, that cars can see us. And we have to be very vigilant. Maybe being hyper-vigilant is even appropriate on a bicycle because, you know, people are busy now. They're not only driving, they're texting, they're putting on lipstick, they're eating their breakfast, they're drinking coffee, they're having, you know, a Scrabble game with their kid in the side panel seat. Everything is going on, so a bicycle is not going to be first and foremost in someone's mind. So those of us on the bike are going to be really watching and checking all the time, even if there's a bike lane. I can remember years ago I was on a bike lane in Edmonton, and I was almost smacked by the mirror of a bus. So you have to really, really watch it. And then Venerable Children also says that we have to be really careful about the situations that we put ourselves in. And we all know this one very well. One story that comes to mind in my experience is that many years ago I was out walking in the woods, and it was a gorgeous day. It was in a very beautiful, pristine place. And so in those hours I was in a very, I thought, you know, it was very safe. I was with a few friends. The leader of the journey knew where we were going. It was just lovely. And then we came back to the city and we stopped at a convenience store to get some water, I think. And in the distance we heard this sound, and it sounded like a huge wedding. And so just like, you know, moths being, you know, sucked in by a light, this sound was so intriguing that we thought, well, we're going to find out what this is, because I'd never heard anything like before in my life, like a big, big wedding. People getting married? Wedding?
That kind of nice about wedding makes.
Okay, good question. There was honking and cheering and singing and merrymaking. And I don't know why we concluded wedding, so that's a good question. But anyway, something was going on and we wanted to find out what it was. And so we headed off and we had the windows rolled down in the car and we didn't know where to go. And pretty soon we find ourselves getting closer to the river. And in Edmonton, the river separates downtown from the north side, which is where we are on. And so we keep going, and the sound is getting louder and louder and louder. And we couldn't imagine what it was. It was a Sunday. And of course most of us, you know, weren't big readers of the news. We just had no clue what was going on. And finally we parked the car and we started walking. And by now the sound is just voluminous. And now we're downtown Edmonton, and there's people on every corner, and there's people cheering. And pretty soon we see that people are drinking like crazy, and it's absolutely a huge scene. And then we find out the Edmonton Oilers had won the Stanley Cup. So it was a huge street party. And we were there for about 15 minutes, long enough to see the whole thing turn from a celebration to getting very ugly. And within minutes, there were people with hockey sticks smashing in store windows. And this was a celebration, celebrating a win of a Stanley Cup. And so there were people smashing windows. The police were just standing back because they were outnumbered. There were people, they had this one police car. We saw them do it. There were 10 people that flipped the police car over on the roof, and they were jumping on it, and the police were just sort of standing there. And it was just a riot. And so we got out of there. You know, it was just obvious that if we had stayed, we would probably have been arrested. But more than that, it was absolutely dangerous. There were so many people there. The police were just outnumbered. So that's a rather dramatic example of, you know, you can put yourself in a situation, if you stick around long enough, for sure it's trouble. And we all have our own stories about our teenage years and 20s and 30s, maybe 40s, of doing the same thing. Maybe 50s. But anyway, Venable said we have to really, really be discerning about where we place ourselves. So, and in the same way, so that's a worldly example, we have to have a sense of caution for cyclic existence. Because as long as we see cyclic existence as cool, and that, you know, I can get some pleasure out of this, whatever I do, then our desire to get out of this situation is not going to be present at all. And without this wish to get free of it, we won't practice the path. And then the most stunning thing of all for me to think about is if we don't practice, we're stuck in this endlessly. Endlessly, endlessly, we'll be born, we'll age, we'll get sick, we'll die. Over and over again, endlessly. So first of all, we have to contemplate the disadvantages of cyclic existence in order to give up the polluted actions that cause it. So the cause of cyclic existence, well, going backwards, the first immediate cause is polluted karma, our actions of body, speech, and mind. Then the cause of polluted karma is the afflictions, the mental states of ignorance, anger, and attachment, jealousy, pride, miserliness, and all of those things that are rooted in ignorance. And so we start off considering the general faults of cyclic existence in order to develop some kind of sense of caution, a sense of its danger. So that's how Venerable Children warmed us up to hear verse 151, which is the following. When there is no end at all to this ocean of suffering, why are you childish people not afraid of drowning in it? So, an ocean of suffering, an ocean of dukkha, there is absolutely no end to it as long as we keep creating the causes for it. Ignorance, afflictions, polluted karma. And then Venerable gave a very compelling example. That is, when you first hear it, it seems, you know, not so striking, but the more I thought about this, it's really frightening, actually. And so she says, it's like the cow that has human intelligence. So this one cow that has human intelligence is stuck in a pen, gets fed regularly, and knows at some point it will be going on a walk to the slaughterhouse. But that's later. You know, right now there's food, there's water, there's a nice pasture, it's got a nice view. The other cows are friendly most of the time. And they're just hanging out, you know, eating. You know, the slaughterhouse is later. And she says, we are like this. We are like this. We think it's later. And it's okay. Because right in this moment, I've got water, there's lights in here, We've got a roof, clean clothes. We've got John here cooking for us. It's okay. So no worries. There's no big hurry. And so then she says, when the Aryas look at us and they see us just wasting time and spinning our wheels like this, you know, if they wouldn't bang their heads because they're Aryas, but, you know, they would be thinking like, you know, what are you doing? What are you thinking? You know, this is cyclic existence. This is not what you want. And so what do we do? What do we get out of this? So what do we get out? What do we get out of cyclic existence? I mean, we've been doing it since beginningless time. This is your chance. This is your chance to respond. Well, what we get is we get born. We get to grow old. We get to experience illness at all ages. And then we die. And we do this over and over again. And then in between all of that, we get what we don't want, for sure. And then when we do get what we want, we're not satisfied or we're unhappy. And it's on and on. And then we get reborn in upper realms, we get reborn in lower realms, and there's absolutely no peace. And as Venerable points out, there's no resting place. So I don't know what people are thinking when they write on their tomb or they have it written on their gravestone, you know, rest in peace. Well, who gets that? So people in general have no awareness of cyclic existence and what it is. And we're living our life grabbing for things and experiences that we think will make us happy, and we push away like crazy all the things that make us unhappy. And we do this 24/7. And at the end, we die. So I watched myself last night. I was getting ready for this talk. But I thought, before I go to bed, I'm going to have some warmed up soy milk with water. And then I got distracted. I started reading something else. It's like, oh, gee. Anyway. And then she says, well, some people think, well, we'll be famous. You know, at some point we'll do something and we'll be really well known. I'll do some research. You know, we'll give a really amazing talk, really amazing Dharma talk on YouTube. People will write about it. They'll debate it. We'll be famous. But she says, okay, so then you get famous for a few minutes. And then somebody decides to write your biography. And do they, you know, do they really know anything about you? I mean, I'm not talking about biographies of spiritual masters. I'm talking about, you know, biographies of, I don't know, Ronald Reagan, movie stars, you know, even people who have done research that's valuable. But, you know, does the biography really get to the core of who that person is? It might sort of touch some moments, but, you know, not really. And then Venerable Children asks a great question. You know, so then somebody does write our biography. But 100 years from now, who's going to remember us? You know, who's going to remember us? Even if you have children. I mean, the people 100 years from now, are they going to really remember who we are or what we did? And so I thought just for a moment it would be fun to find out what was going on in 1914. Some outstanding events 100 years ago. So if you're a history buff in the room or online, you might come up with some. So what happened 100 years ago that you can remember?
In 1914?
Very good. That was a big one. Yeah. World War I. But you probably don't remember that Prince Wilhelm von Wied became the king of Albania. And you might not remember that George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion premiered in 1914 on May 6th. And you might not remember that the British House of Lords rejected the women's suffrage movement. But you're right, World War I began. And that began with Austria-Hungary declaring war on Serbia. So poor Serbia continually gets the hits. And then interestingly enough, His Holiness the 13th Dalai Lama, in that same year, offered to place 1,000 troops at the disposal of the government for the war with Germany. But what we don't see in all these little things you can Google on the internet is which meditator achieved, you know, direct realization of emptiness, or entered the path of accumulation, or things like that. But for sure, we probably don't remember our direct ancestors. And even if we do have someone in our family who's big on rooting out our ancestry, what do we know about that person really? So in the explanation of this verse 151, Gyaltsa Pje goes on to say, he actually targets the afflictions, and in particular he talks about the fetters. So then Venerable Children points out there's two basic Abhidharma systems from the Tibetan perspective. One is Vasubandhu's, and that is based on the treasury of knowledge. And the other one is Asanga's, and his is based on the compendium of knowledge. And this one, Asanga's, lists 9 fetters. So I'm not going to go through those right now, just for time. But Venerable did go into Vasubandhu's. So we'll take some time right now looking at these 10 fetters, which is like the Pali tradition. So Vasubandhu divides these 10 fetters into 5 lower and 5 higher fetters. And the first 5 are called the lower fetters because they lead us to rebirth in the desire realm. And the last 5 are called the higher fetters, and when we eradicate those, we become arhats. So these first 5 fetters, these hindrances, these obstacles to our practice that keep us in the desire realm. The first one is the view of a personal identity. So we're a compound of 5 aggregates that we call myself, and we take the aggregates to be our identity. This view holds our identity to exist within the 5 aggregates, or in relationship to the 5 aggregates. And from the viewpoint of lower schools, it's thinking that there is a permanent, partless, independent self, or a self-substantially existent self. Then the second one is doubt. And this is a vacillating mind that equivocates between Dharma knowledge that is important for liberation, and then doubting. And doubting things like the Buddha is fully enlightened, or doubting that the Dharma is the ultimate truth, or doubting that the true paths are able to eliminate cyclic existence, or doubting that the Arya Sangha have realized the true paths. And obviously, if we have these doubts in our mind, then it becomes very difficult to practice because we don't even have the trust or confidence in the path. And we also don't believe that beings who are practicing it are doing something substantial. Then the third fetter is the view of holding bad ethics and modes of conduct as supreme. Now, I don't think we have anything to worry about here because this, well, we may. This is clinging to mistaken codes of ethics and mistaken practices and holding these as virtuous. So, for example, thinking that extreme ascetic practices of self-mortification are going to bring you enlightenment, torturing the body, fasting for long periods of time, sitting in fire, doing Brahminical rituals that emphasize the exact way that you do a ritual is most important. Now, we might fall into that one sometimes if we really get fixated on doing something precisely, but our mind is really not thinking about what's important. Number 4 is sensual desire, attraction to objects of sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. And the 5th one is malice or ill will, the wish to harm another living being. So these lower fetters are eliminated when we attain the level of non-returner. And as mentioned before, the 5 upper fetters are eliminated by arhatship. So number 6 is desire for existence in the form realm. And this is attachment to being born in the form realm. 7 is desire for existence in the formless realm. And with both of these, 6 and 7, a person is attached to that kind of existence and wants to go on abiding there. So one can get attached to deep states of samadhi, and they don't practice to gain the wisdom that will get them out of cyclic existence. Number 8 is conceit. And this is the subtle conceit of an existing I. And this is Venerable's favorite phrase, the conceit of I am. And this differs from the view of a personal identity, which is a conceptual view holding a permanent self according to this school. After the view of a personal identity is eliminated, you are not thinking of yourself as some kind of soul or permanent self, so you are not thinking I am this or I am that, but you still have the thought I am. And this conceit of I is just that thought I am, which is more subtle than thinking I'm Canadian, I'm Ukrainian, or whatever. So even though a non-returner knows the thought I am to be deluded and not true, they don't hold on to the idea I am or identify with it. Still, the thought I am arises spontaneously. A non-returner is no longer reborn in the desire realm, and they have eliminated the view of an identity, but the conceit of I am still remains in the mind. Number 9 is excitement or restlessness. In the Sanskrit tradition, in the context of developing serenity, excitement is where your mind is carried away by an object of attachment. So if this is a higher fetter, this is not talking about objects of sensual attachment, like it is in the context of developing serenity. So perhaps here, as Venerable says, restlessness is a better translation. And this restlessness is present in any mind that is not liberated. So that's something good to keep in mind. And this hindrance may still arise for a non-returner if the person is not mindful and diligent. But this can be overcome quickly. As long as the mind is not liberated, there is a certain restlessness, a certain agitation due to the afflictions. And 10 is ignorance. And this is the root of samsara. According to Vasubandhu and the Pali system, it is blindness or unknowing regarding the true nature. It's a fogginess, an obscuration that will not let you see how things exist. But for the Prasangikas, it is actively grasping things to exist in the opposite way from how they do exist. So, to sum up this verse, Gyaltsabje says, "Fraught with the whirlpool of birth and death, why aren't you ordinary childish people drowning in it since beginningless time? Why aren't you afraid? Why aren't you concerned with what is happening to you?" So this is a question for everyone, including those of us who have met the Dharma. How much of the day are we thinking about the situation that we're in and that it's frightful? We're in an insecure state. And yet, this is the situation we're in. So right now, we have the luxury to practice the Dharma. And those who are fleeing for their lives right this minute can't even possibly reflect on the Dharma. And if we look at this one country that's constantly in the news, Syria, according to Time magazine, 6 million Syrians have been pushed from their homes, and 2.4 million Syrians have crossed the border, making them the second largest refugee population in the world. So these people are ending up in makeshift camps. And according to a report written this year in February, Syrians are about to replace Afghans as the world's largest refugee population, fleeing a conflict where barrel bombs leave bodies in pieces, and a generation of children are physically and emotionally scarred. Refugees find shelter wherever they can. And the people who are helping out in these countries have seen families living in rooms with no heat, no running water, in abandoned chicken coops and storage sheds. And most of these people who end up in these camps still have to find a way to pay rent, even if it's for a derelict structure. And without any legal way to work in these camps in Jordan or Lebanon or wherever they end up, they struggle to find odd jobs, they accept low wages that don't often cover their most basic needs. The lack of clean water and sanitation in crowded makeshift settlements is an urgent concern. Diseases like cholera and polio can easily spread, and even more life-threatening diseases are happening without medical services. In some areas with the largest refugee populations, water shortages have reached emergency levels. The supply is as low as 30 liters per person per day, which is one-tenth of what the average American uses. According to the UN, more than half of all Syrian refugees are under the age of 18. Most have been out of school for months, if not years. The youngest are confused and scared by their experiences, lacking the sense of safety and the home that they need. And the older children are forced to grow up way too fast, finding work and taking care of their family in desperate circumstances. So you can imagine, you know, here we are. You know, if we're not at the Abbey, we're still having the circumstance of listening to teachings at some point. And yet we find excuses why we can't sit down and practice. And other people in the world are just fighting every moment. So these people have a sense of the dangers, and they can't practice. And we have the situation of practice, and we lose sense of the danger that we're in. There was one article written in Reuters that I'm going to read to you. It was just so striking, just to give you an example of what people are experiencing right this minute. The old man does not give his name. He does not say anything at all. Lying under a blanket on a thin mattress in the corner of a dark prefabricated metal container that these days serves as a home, he greets a visitor with a baleful stare. Then slowly he turns his face to the wall and pulls his red and black checkered scarf over his head. His misery, shame, anger, and isolation seem complete. He's beyond reach. But his tacit statement is both unmistakable and painfully eloquent. Once, not long ago in Syria, he, like so many others, had a family, a house, a job, friends, neighborhood, and a purpose. He was a man in his own right. Life made sense. Now, inside the confines of the sprawling Za'atari refugee camp, a few miles away from the Syrian border in northwest Jordan, he appears as a number, a statistic, his life a shadow of what it was. He seems to be wholly displaced, physically, geographically, socially, and psychologically. All the people here in this camp have seen something horrible. They have been hiding and running. They have experienced killing, torture, spying, and betrayal. These people don't trust anybody anymore. And earlier today, I read that the latest statistics on refugees in the world, I think they now number, oh gosh, the number escapes me, so I won't say a number and be wrong, but it's astronomical, the number of people who are refugees. If you're a refugee, the chances of practicing the Dharma probably aren't going to enter your mind, because survival is number one. So moving on, the next verse talks about how to generate aversion to samsara and the inappropriateness of attachment to youth. So Venerable calls the person asking the questions Joe Blow. I'll just say it's most of us. Certainly me. So Joe, most of us will say, well, sure, cyclic existence has disadvantages, but those who are proud of their youth, you know, there's no need to be afraid. So the young have this attitude that, or at least some young, this young, had the attitude that every sense pleasure I could get, I was going to grab. And besides, you know, with the vitality that I experienced then, nothing's going to happen to me, not for a very long time, and I've got all of this strength, and I'm pretty much invincible. You know, trouble's not going to come my way, and if it does, I can manage it, for sure. So, this is verse 152. Youth lies behind, and then once more it is ahead. Though one imagines it will last, in this world it is like a race. So, Youth doesn't last. Therefore, pride in being young and attractive and healthy is very inappropriate, because what you are proud of is in a state of constant decay. In this life, youth is behind old age. In other words, we've already experienced youth, and now we're experiencing aging. And as Venerable Chogyam pointed out, the definition of old age changes every decade, as well as the definition of middle age. And I'll never forget the time, I think it was my 26th birthday, and there's family around, and one of my uncles is a doctor, and so at one point, in the midst of all of this merrymaking, he said, "Well, congratulations, you've now hit middle age." I said, "What?" He said, "Yes, biologically, you've hit middle age." And I said, "Thank you." But anyway, whatever age we're at, I think we all think, we have this thinking in our head that we're still young, despite what the mirror says. And we have this idea, I mean, you can talk to anyone at any age and they will tell you, you know, "I don't feel like the age of my body." I meet people like this all the time. I remember also when I turned 10, I was quite sad that day. And I thought, I've hit the two-digit numbers. It's all downhill from here. And you know, it's kind of true. But I thought that day, you know, 10. So then, as I was doing some reading about this thing of aging, I came across this phrase I'd never read before. Maybe you know this, but it's this term called ageism. Has anyone read about ageism? Okay, I'll have to admit my ignorance. Anyway, we commit this all the time with our speech. And so if you don't quite know what it is yet, it's a form of discrimination, of course, and prejudice. And typically, I think the whole thing started with it being targeted towards seniors. But now ageism can apply to, you know, tossing it out to any age group. And if it ends up being discrimination or leaving people out or including people, it's, you know, it's not a great thing. So the thing, though, with this being this ageism thing, with it targeting seniors, is that we can commit this error of speech even in a joking sort of way and still cause harm. And so I think the older we get, the more sensitive we'll be to this. But, you know, any comments that sort of end up, you know, with people talking about the fact they can't remember something, or noticing that somebody can't remember something, or, you know, people pointing out that elderly people move slowly, things like that. There's even concerns about doctors, you know, making the mistake when they come in, you know, if an elderly person comes in with their child who's 75 and the doctor talks to the child instead of the patient, you know, this kind of thing has been reported. And then commercials, of course, if you watch TV still, you know, anything to do with youth is glamorized, anything to do with aging, well, it's not great. So now there's certain laws and regulations that are making sure that we don't commit this. And so the one example that was given in this definition of ageism is that people are having a nice, friendly conversation, and then at some point it comes out that the person is 78. And so they tell this to their new friend, and the person hearing this says, "78! You don't look at all like 78. You look great!" You know, so what does a 78-year-old look like anyway, and why is it great, you know, that you don't look your age? You know, why can't we just be happy with 78? So what is this getting towards? You know, we're living in this culture that idolizes youth, and that getting old is actually a mistake. It's something to be sort of condemned and something that we want to avoid. And then I was reading about all of this 3 days ago, the headline of the CBC News had this title: "Is Hillary Clinton Too Old to Be President?" So, apparently, Hillary will turn 67 in October. And if she, you know, enters the race, which they're suggesting that she will, and if she wins, then by the time she moves into the White House, she'll be 69. And most U.S. presidents have been in their 40s or 50s, as this article points out, when they take office, including the president, current president, Barack Obama. So Clinton would be one of those older ones. But there are all these people doing this buzz speculation now, and this one guy called Howard Kurtz, I don't know who he is, but he says she's encountering some things that are going to give people a Haiti to talk about. First of all, the sad news is women politicians are scrutinized more than men when it comes to their birthdays. Well, we know all that. And then she might have to worry about the wrinkles in a way that male candidates do not. And that's probably true. But, he says, if it is Clinton on the ballot in 2016, she could try and counter this Republican spin stuff on her age by arguing that she's been working in politics virtually as long as some of their potential candidates. So, you know, she's had the experience, and they don't, and she can lead the country. But if she doesn't win, it won't be because of her age, and that is the opinion. So we'll see. So, back to Aryadeva. Right now, youth is behind old age, but after death, youth is once more in front of old age. Although we imagine remaining young, youth, old age, and death compete as if in a race, claiming, I'm ahead. No, I'm ahead. No, I'm ahead. And it keeps circling like this from one life to the next. But none of them can remain ahead. So it is unreasonable to be proud either of your youth or your wisdom in your old age, because none of that is going to remain. So then most of us say, well, though one must go on to another life, it's not frightening. And Aryadeva says, in worldly existence, there is never rebirth of one's own free will. Being under others' control, who with intelligence would be fearless? So, this is verse 153. And Aryadeva says, appropriateness of fear, wisdom fear, is essential. We don't have the power to choose our own rebirth. We are under afflictions. We are dependent on other factors, and they all trace back to ignorance. Under control of afflictions and karma, what intelligent person would feel fearless? Like a piece of wood swept by the current. Here is me, and I'm in charge. I'm going to make things happen. Really? We can't prevent our body from aging, despite what people will pay and endure through undergoing plastic surgeries to get things lifted here and tucked there. And this current Botox rage thing is really, really very interesting. And I've heard a number of people tell me that they've noticed that their own doctor goes from being anti-Botox to pro-Botox because they see the income advantages. And there's the demand. And so I'll never forget this situation. I was at the Calgary airport flying back to the state of Washington, and I was excited to be going back here, and I was behind this woman who was extremely well-groomed, and I thought, well, anyway, I was behind her, trying not to notice all of her accessories and her clothes and everything, but I was quite taken with the outfit. It was a great outfit. The hair was great. And I thought for the longest time that I was behind someone who must have been in her late 20s, early 30s. And so, you know, how the lines snake around like this. And as she came around this way and I was still this way, I almost screamed. Because the person I thought was 28 was more like 78. And I'm not kidding you. It was like, ah! But she looked great. For 78, there was not a wrinkle on her face. The hair, maybe it was a wig, was fantastic. She was just decked out. The accessories, she was smiling, extremely friendly. She was saying hello to everybody. And pretty soon she was talking to me because we were across from each other. And I was just trying not to stare. But, you know, I was just like... But she was so friendly and she looked amazing. But the one thing about plastic surgery is the stance of the body as we age is unmistakable. Now, she wasn't hunched over. She was great. But, you know, the hands. She didn't have her hands done. So there it was, you know. But you could tell that looking like this gave her vitality. I mean, she was she was beaming. And she was talking to everyone. But then I thought of her suffering, you know, every night in the mirror. You know, must be like this, you know, and making those trips frequently to the doctor, and, you know, it's got a little gray hair here. And, you know, the cost, the surgery, the pain, and all this so that she can be young. I was just stunned by it. Very striking. But I'm really glad I didn't scream. Okay. All right, where are we here? Okay. So we are dependent on other factors, and they all trace back to ignorance. Under control of afflictions and karma, what intelligent person would feel fearless? We cannot prevent our body from aging. We can't prevent our body from falling ill. We can't prevent the body from dying. We get ourselves into uncomfortable situations. We can't control our mind. So it's foolish to think that I'm in control of things and I can choose what happens to me when our minds are so much out of control and karma influences what happens to us. So this oh my goodness, really? 6:51. Okay, well, it's a good thing it's going to be 2 weeks. This idea of control, and I'm just going to go back to this idea of how we can't control things, and then we think we've got ourselves in a good situation, but then we can't control the good situation. And 2 days ago, one of our friends was up to drive Venerable Children in to Spokane to catch the plane the next day. And he told me one story, actually told me a number of stories, but this one story he told me is just striking too in this regard. He used to be in the military, and there was this circumstance one day where this crew of people that he knew were going to go up into this plane that actually fuels other planes, so it's an air-fueling plane. And they were practicing some kind of maneuver. Anyway, they have a law in the military, in the Air Force anyway, if you have a head cold, you don't fly. And the reason for that is that if the plane depressurizes and you've got a cold, you can be in trouble. So there was this one person on that day who was, he couldn't get in the plane because of this head cold. And so the plane takes off and does its thing, whatever they're doing. And the person who was denied access to flying with the crew that day gets in his car to go back home. And if you can believe this, something happened to the plane and it ran into trouble and it crashed. So the guy who's in the car, you know, was spared the crash. However, in driving his car on the base, he was close enough to the crash that his car was engulfed in flames, and he died. And so you think, you know, here we are, you know, we can put ourselves in situations that seem safe, and yet the karma created in past life zooms in and takes over. It just was a striking story. And he told me another one, but I'll say that maybe for next week. So then most of us will think, like Job Lowe, though unable to cut through worldly existence in this life because of being enthralled by pleasure, one will try to do so in a future rebirth. Everything is going really well. Good family, career, travel. I can ski anywhere I like. So many good concerts to go to. And there's future lives. There's many of them. There's endless future lives. And right now I've got this situation. There's a concert. Blah, blah is in Spokane. I'm going to go because there's these future lives. So we can think this. And, you know, for those who are famous and wealthy in this life, or gifted, or enjoying an academic career and doing great research, you know, this would be an easy conclusion to reach. I mean, who of us in this room hasn't thought this at one point? Future lives, no problem. I'll go to this very interesting documentary. It's not for the benefit of all sentient beings, but it's interesting. So Arya Deva says, the future is endless, and you are always a common being. Act so that it will never occur again, be as it was in the past. And so Arya Deva goes on to explain this. future rebirths are endless as long as we don't develop wisdom and get ourselves out of samsara. And past rebirths are beginningless, and throughout the past, we were only common beings with minds overwhelmed by afflictions. And so the one question Venerable asked us to think about is, you know, how many bodies have we had since beginningless time? And when you think of the body that you have right now, that I have right now, how attached am I to this? Pretty attached. And then what happens when I experience pain? Well, I get concerned. And then if we face surgery, I get afraid. And when we're rejecting the results of aging in the form of wrinkles and the gradual diminishing of physical vitality, how do we feel? And then think, how many bodies did I have in the past? And with each one of those, when I had it, I was so attached to it. And where are those bodies now? And if those bodies existed, they would fill the whole universe. Beginningless bodies. So, having met the Dharma in this life, Aryadeva says, act so that the present and the future won't be as meaningless as the past. In many lives, we didn't encounter the Dharma or have respect for it. So now, having this life, as if by what Venerable Children calls a streak of luck or some kind of miracle, we should really make it meaningful to do something to liberate ourselves so that we break this continuity of rebirths. Verse 154. Make it, the advice with this verse is to make effort to abandon the causes of rebirth and samsara. Aryadeva says, the future is endless. Act so that it will never occur again. Be as it was in the past. Throughout the past, we were common beings with minds overwhelmed by karma and afflictions. And then Venerable cited this sutra called the Array of Tree Trunk Sutras, which says, think of all the bodies, all the lives you have wasted, lived under the influence of wanting pleasure all the time, protecting our honor, winning, being comfortable, being right, being loved, all those things. And instead of that, engage in the discipline of seeking awakening and seek to destroy desire. And how do we do this? We do this by developing the discipline of seeking awakening through the higher training of ethical conduct, concentration, wisdom, and bodhicitta. So, verse 155. Most of us in Job Lo then ask a question. Well, does the cycle of rebirths have an end or not? If it does, one will gain freedom without the need for effort. If it doesn't, effort to cut through the cycle of birth and death is senseless, since despite effort, one will not gain freedom. So, why should we make the effort to do something about this situation? We can just float along, be comfortable, have a latte, not to be concerned about anything, just go with the flow. And in answer to that, Aryadeva, in verse 155, says, the conjunction of a listener, what is to be heard, and an exponent, this is very rare. In brief, the cycle of rebirths neither has nor has not an end. So I think what I'll finish with is this conjunction of these very particular things. And Venerable Children really emphasized this. The conjunction of a listener, which is someone with a precious human rebirth, it's us, who is ready to generate the spiritual path, that connected to what is heard, the teachings on emptiness, connected to the exponent, the Buddha, these three things occurring simultaneously in the world are very rare. To have the Buddha who is able to teach the teachings on emptiness, and as Venerable points out, the Buddha could have taught very many other things. That part could have been left out. But the Buddha taught this. Or, at some point, these teachings on emptiness could have been corrupted So having these two, and from our own side, having all the circumstances to be able to practice, getting these three things together is very rare. And when she said that, and my friend, our friend here, this is perfect timing, she says, the cats and the insects, mudita the moose, all of these living beings, the birds, the Ramans, they're at the abbey. The cats are here. They hear teachings. So they had good completing karma for the conditions of their lives to be here, but the propelling karma that threw them into an animal rebirth was destructive karma. So given the fact that we have these three situations coming together, which is so rare, and I think as we continue on the path and we develop, I think we'll get to see more and more deeply how precious this is, then we'll be really motivated to take advantage of these teachings and reflect on them and review them again and again and again, and really keep these teachings in our hearts so that we can eventually become fully awakened beings for the benefit of all. So it's time, I mean, I've got another 20 pages, but we also have possibly, we have next Thursday, there's no guarantee. If I keel over, I'll assign someone here to read through this, and we'll continue with chapter 7. You can ask a question, and we'll probably have to forward it to the Venerable Children.
No, I just want you to repeat something from your first one.
Okay.
I wanted to make sure I got this, and I didn't really. When you were talking about Vasubandhu, you talked about the 10 fetters.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to that.
Sure.
And you were describing the 5 lower ones and the 5 higher ones.
Okay.
Could you, the 5 higher ones, when you etiquette them, it would be the Arhatship.
Yeah.
And the 5 lower ones, when you eradicate them, lead to non-return or regret. You said something else about that. I thought, I wrote in my notes that it keeps us in the desire realm, but that can't be right. Mm-hmm. The 5 fetters keep us in...
Let's see. Yes.
Lead to rebirth in the desire realm. Okay.
Yeah, these first 5, if we don't eradicate them, then they lead to rebirth in the desire realm.
Also
the desire.
Don't
go to the form of the formless realms.
Right. Okay. Yeah. 3 realms, 6 locations. 3 locations.
To be continued.
Dear listener, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May that precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born and no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain of pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Glory.